This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Today's program is going to be on how we can help the blind and visually impaired. But before we get into the program, I want to make a comment. As those of you who listen commonly or regularly, perhaps I should say, recognize that I try to promote science as much as I can because I think it helps us, if you understand how science works, understand what's real and what's not real and how we can continue to improve, particularly medicine. And when science is applied to medicine, it allows us or encourages us to constantly test our assumptions and reassure ourselves that we're doing the best that we can in our how we diagnose and treat. And so the current jargon for that in medicine and allopathic medicine is evidence-based medicine, where we're constantly testing therapies and diagnostic procedures. It leads to better and constant efforts at improvement. What is, I think, gratifying to me and what caught my attention about what I'm going to talk about is that it's beginning perhaps, hopefully, to slip in to some of the alternative and complementary aspects of care as well. That's been, I think, fair to say, lacking in that area. And this is a report of an article written by some chiropractors in the journal Chiropractic and Osteopathy in 2008, volume 16, number 10. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read the major findings, which are reported in Consumer Health Digest, February 26, 2009. This was a team of research-oriented chiropractors who really kind of called for some dramatic changes in how chiropractic is practiced. And here are the major summaries as they are represented in Consumer Health Digest. One, chiropractic's market share is dwindling. Despite its longevity, the profession has not succeeded in establishing respect within mainstream society. A Gallup poll found that it is rated dead last among healthcare professions with regard to ethics and honesty. Many chiropractors aggressively and dogmatically without evidence have opposed public health measures such as vaccination and fluoridation. The profession must become more involved in teaching patients how to stay healthy without frequent, endless visits to chiropractic offices. Many chiropractic colleges embrace the concept of spinal subluxation as the cause of a variety of internal diseases and the metaphysical pseudo-religious idea of, quote, innate intelligence, end quote, flowing through spinal nerves with spinal subluxations impeding this flow. This concept lacks scientific foundation and should not be taught at chiropractic institutions as part of the standard curriculum. There is a tremendous void in how chiropractic graduates develop any meaningful hands-on clinical experience with real patients in real-life situations. And finally, the chiropractic profession has an obligation to actively divorce itself from metaphysical explanations of health and disease, as well as to actively regulate itself in refusing to tolerate fraud, abuse, and quackery, which are more rampant in the chiropractic organizations than in other healthcare professionals. Today, my guests are Carla Jutsey. She's Executive Director of the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired here in Anchorage. And with me also in the studio is Deborah Gilley. Deborah is a certified low-vision therapist and a certified orientation and mobility instructor. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Another thing I often do is I often try to start with definitions, which gets back to my science background. If we don't know what we're talking about, it's hard to be clear. So let's define low vision, and also if you don't mind, maybe try to put some definition on blindness, which is one of those things I'd have a heck of a time doing.
Well, I'll start with blindness and let Deborah talk about low vision. There's a leak. Definition of legal blindness that often helps people. And That is defined two ways. One is based on your acuity, or how clearly you see. And the definition of legal blindness is 20/200 in your best eye after you have your eyeglasses on. So it's with correction. And the second definition of legal blindness has to do with the periphery, how widely you see. So if you have a visual field of 20 degrees or less, that's another definition of legal blindness, much like seeing the world through a paper towel tube.
And the peripheral vision is a tremendously important aspect of vision that often is not understood or appreciated.
Yes. Absolutely. So if you imagine yourself looking through a paper towel tube, you can easily think about how you would run into chairs, you'd hit tables, there'd be a lot you would have difficulty picking up in your environment. And the term blindness is often people make their own decision about when to apply that word to themselves. Mm-hmm. So it is often not a precise definition.
Yeah. I'm going to try to put that in some perspective, being someone who's without correction legally blind, but with correction, fortunately, I am not. When you say 20/200, that means that a person with 20/200 vision sees at 200 feet what a normal, quote, normal person sees at 20 feet.
Wrong. The other way around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. 20, sees at 20 feet right. What people see at 200. I'm sorry. I said that wrong.
You're correct.
Right.
That's exactly correct.
Right. And I was 20/300 before I ever had – well, even with glasses, I was corrected down, and then I've had some surgery. So I'm much, much, much better. But I can tell you, without correction, I couldn't see the big E on the Snellen charts.
Correct. Right.
So
okay.
To give you some idea. If I squinted really hard and did some things, I could do it. So 20/200 would be difficult to probably read the top letters on the Snellen.
Well, you could read the top letters on the Snellen chart, but you would have difficulty reading the newspaper.
Okay.
Newspaper size print is 20/50 vision. And so when someone comes into the low vision clinic, we really try to get their vision down to 20/50 or better.
Okay.
So that they can read the newspaper, they can read most textbooks, that sort of thing. You know, any kind of book that they would like to access is usually going to be in the 20/50 range.
Okay. And then low vision is probably even harder to do.
Low vision is really any visual impairment that cannot be corrected by eyeglasses, contacts, surgeries, medicine, etc., that interferes with your quality of life.
Okay.
And that's sort of low vision in a nutshell, but it can encompass so many different things.
One of the common myths is that people are either sighted or they're blind. And in reality, most of the people we are able to support at the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired or are somewhere in between. 90% of the people we help with the training and resources at the center have some functional vision.
Let me remind our listeners about how to get in touch with us today. You're listening to Line One. We're talking about the Alaska Center for Blind and Visually Impaired. And if you've got questions about anything you hear today or you have comments that you want to make, here's some ways to get in touch with us. During the program, we're live at 550-8433. That's a local number, 550-8433. And if you need a toll-free number, it's 1-888-353-5752. And you can also email us at line1, spell it out, all one word, LINEONE, at kska.org. So what are some functional consequences? What happens with low vision or functional blindness, if that's the right term then?
Well, it would be low vision. When somebody has low vision, it can interfere with so many different aspects of their life. Independent living is one of those. To be able to continue to cook, answer your mail, take care of your home, do your housekeeping, all of those things can be a problem when you have low vision. Also, social interactions. If you don't recognize your friends when they come in the room anymore, you can't tell your family members apart, it's really hard for them to understand that this is caused by a visual impairment if it hasn't been identified. And then also recreation can be a problem if you can't, if you've lost your depth perception. If glare is difficult for you, we have some clients that really want to remain active in their sports. We show sunglasses and different aids that can still help them to do the hobbies, the crafts, the fly fishing, the things that they want to be able to do.
Another consequence also is that it can threaten employment. If people have an eye condition, they're losing their eyesight, it can be a concern to them to hang on to their job.
Carlo, let's back up just a second also. Tell us a little bit about the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired. How long has it been around? Where are you located? What's really your purpose? We didn't really get into that very important fundamental.
Well, I'm glad you asked. The center was founded in 1977, so we're going on, 32 years now. We are a training and resource center, and our mission is helping Alaskans who are losing their eyesight or have lost it to learn new ways to achieve the goals they have in their lives and if they want to continue to work for employment. We are a statewide organization. We serve the entire state of Alaska. We're organized as a 501c3 nonprofit. And we're all about helping people achieve the success they want to have in their lives, even though they have low vision or blindness.
The only office you have is locally?
Yes.
Even though you serve the whole state?
Yes.
Okay.
We do have various programs that take us out into communities throughout the state.
And the funding. How do you support yourself?
Well, about 35% of our funding comes from fees for our services, primarily through the Alaska Division of Vocational Rehabilitation for training we provide to people who are clients of the Division of Voc Rehab. We also have both government grants to provide services and some private grants. And we do fundraising. Mm-hmm. About 18% of our budget currently comes from donations from the community.
Okay. And if people want to get in touch with you some way because of today's show or otherwise, how do they go about it?
Well, our phone number in Anchorage, 248-7770. Our website is www.alaskabvi.org. That's Alaska, B as in blind, V as in visually, I as in impaired, .org. And we understand there are a few problems with the website today. We're trying to get that fixed, but there'll be a link through.
Yeah, through our program. If you go to ksk.org/line1, you can pick it up, and we have several links, including yours, that is working. And then there's three other organizations I thought we might mention. You mentioned before, AFB.org is the American Federation of the Blind, which is a source.
The American Foundation for the Blind.
Okay.
And several things you can find there. If you have a loved one with a visual impairment in another state and you'd like to know where there might be services similar to ours, there is a service finder through that website. There's also an excellent senior site and a site called Family Connect for families with children with visual impairments, all through the AFB.org site. If you'd like to know more about low vision, the lighthouse.org website has...
It has quite a bit of information on the major causes of visual impairments, symptoms of them, treatments, and it also has a simulation so that if family members kind of want to get an idea of what their loved one is seeing, they can click on links that will take them to simulations.
And a third one, preventblindness.org, again, has lots of information about eye health, various eye conditions, what you need to do to stay healthy.
And just to remind everyone, you didn't have to write all those down, although if you got it all down, that's good. You can just go to ksk.org/line1, and you can link to any of those from our website. Deborah, what are, you know, it seems kind of obvious to ask the question that what are common symptoms of low vision and so forth, but I suspect there's some symptoms that people might not be aware of that would be important. Do you want to kind of talk about that?
We have a standard list. Signs of low vision are difficulty distinguishing colors, difficulty reading, difficulty distinguishing objects, difficulty seeing objects, not just distinguishing them, but being able to see them at all, difficulty recognizing faces, difficulty seeing signs and posts when you're out shopping to be able to do your grocery shopping, and difficulty recognizing potential hazards in your environment, such as curbs, steps, uneven terrains, open doors, those sorts of things.
How about night vision? I was doing a couple of things. Is that an issue that comes up very much, especially for drivers?
Yes, it does. Night vision can be affected by some of the different eye conditions. And peripheral vision is also an issue with drivers, that if they have eye conditions that leave them with central vision, then they won't see the child running out in front of the road to get the ball, that kind of thing. And if they're losing their central vision with an eye condition such as macular degeneration, then, of course, that leads to a whole host of problems when you're driving as well. So that is an issue that comes up a lot in the clinic, that people come in and say, can you just get me driving again? And we actually have to talk about when they need to give up their licenses.
How do people get to you? What's the standard? Is there a fairly typical way, or is it lots of different
ways?
Well,
there are two ways. One way is someone listening to this program today says, I think that's something I'd like to learn more about, and they can call us directly. Another frequent way people get to us is their eye doctor or some other healthcare provider refers them to us. But people who are your listeners can feel free to call us directly if they would like.
Yeah, I know, as we mentioned before the program, before my mother died, she was having tremendous problems, progressive problems with macular degeneration. And the idea I always thought was, well, you just talk to your eye doctor. But the fact is the eye doctor makes the diagnosis, knows what's going on. But he's not necessarily always the best for all the adaptions and the therapies and available. So unfortunately, my mother had been referred in a different state to an organization similar to yours.
Right. Eye doctors don't typically have training in low vision in their ordinary course of study. And something else that happens frequently, and I've heard this from colleagues in other states as well, is that a doctor will frequently say to a patient, there's nothing more that I can do. Appropriately saying to the patient, the limits of correction with come to the limit of correction with eyeglasses, or come to the limit of
medical intervention.
What the patient frequently hears, unfortunately, is there's nothing more that can be done. And we work with the eye doctors and ask them to add that second sentence that says there is more that can be done functionally. And in Alaska, the agency that provides those services is the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, because there is always something that we can do to help people who have experienced vision loss to continue to have the kind of life they want to live.
The other consideration that we've run into here, especially in Alaska, with there not being an optometrist or ophthalmologist that does low vision, is that it is very time intensive. When someone comes in to see me, they're generally with me for an hour to an hour and a half of one-on-one, going through aids and devices, talking about what their exact problems are, and trying to match them with what I have and their needs are. An eye doctor just doesn't have the time in the course of a day to spend that much time with each client. So instead, we have those resources at our center, and they refer to us. And then we make those appointments.
And we have a room full. Our low vision clinic includes a room full of the whole range of specialized magnifiers. That's another thing. People don't realize that these devices even exist. And so we work very hard to keep our demonstration devices up to date so people have the opportunity to try out, based on their eye condition and their goals, a whole variety of magnifiers and other devices that can be of assistance to them. And that's very expensive, again, for an eye doctor's office to support.
Mm-hmm. And we really want to encourage that people, there are magazines, there are resources that are available for buying equipment. But when you have low vision, it's very specific to each person. So to open a catalog and say, oh, I'm going to buy a magnifier that magnifies it three times may not be what the need is for that individual person. So I often have people that come into the clinic who say, oh, magnifiers don't work for me. And then I say, well, give me a minute. Mm-hmm. And we do the background history. We go over everything. I do a quick different kind of eye chart that they have to read. And then I start matching them up with the correct magnifiers. And it's just like heaven opened for them.
Yeah. So what I'm also hearing is if someone is out there looking for something to help them and they don't seem to have anything else, you guys would be a very good place to go to discuss the options.
Absolutely.
And not waste some money on something that's just not right.
Right. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Remind our listeners again, this is Line One. We're talking with Carla Jutsey and Deborah Gilley of the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired. If you've got questions or comments about things you hear today, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch. 550-8433, 550-8433 is our local number. We'll be here between 2 and 3. As you may know, we repeat each evening as a rebroadcast. Used to be about 7. Now it's at 8 o'clock with an expanded coverage of health and wellness programming that's being done on FM 91.1. So you can listen again, but 8 o'clock on KSKA FM 91.1. Also, we've got an 800 number or an 888 number for those out of town, 1-888-353-5752. And you can reach us by email at lineone@kska.org. Give us some examples of the kinds of medical problems or diagnoses that individuals come to you with.
The main ones that we see in our clinic would be diabetic retinopathy and macular degeneration are probably the two big ones that come in. We do have individuals that have glaucoma and some that have cataracts. Now, in today's day and age, there is surgery for cataracts, so we see less and less of individuals that have cataracts. And cataracts are a clouding of the lens where things just aren't as bright, intense as they used to be, and it can become quite severe where you can't recognize traffic lights, you can't recognize people's faces. There are surgeries now where you can have the old lens taken out and a new lens put in. But if somebody has another medical condition or eye condition where that surgery is prohibitive, then we do see people for cataracts as well.
Are there particular symptoms of diabetic retinopathy or macular degeneration that are specific to those particular illnesses? Again, I'm thinking of people out there maybe having some eye problems and may not know the reasons for them yet.
Well, macular degeneration is a deficit in the macula of the retina. The macula of the retina is the very central back portion of the retina. And the macula is the point on the retina that's responsible for your clearest vision, so that 20/20 vision. It's also responsible for your color vision, and it's responsible for your central vision. So the peripheral vision, the great news about macular degeneration is that it's not an eye condition that you go totally blind from usually. You usually keep your peripheral vision intact, but it's the central vision. So when you look at somebody's face and it's no longer so clear, when you're trying to read a book and you put on your glasses, you've been to your eye doctor's, you know, that's the time to go back. If lines begin to get wavy when you're reading them, those are all indicators of macular degeneration. Diabetic retinopathy is a condition of bleeding in the retina. It's where, because of the diabetes, the blood vessels become weakened and they hemorrhage in the retina. And that can actually lead to sort of floating blind spots where you actually have vision missing here and there. But any of those things, if you notice any changes in your vision, then we highly recommend you get back to your eye doctor and be seen. And if you've been diagnosed with those eye conditions, then we recommend that you keep your regular checkups. And if you see any differences, that you get checked out right away.
It's important to add that for diabetic retinopathy and for glaucoma, there may already be damage to your eyes before you experience any symptoms. Mm-hmm. So a regular eye exam is important. And when you get an eye exam for new glasses, you may not always get a dilated eye exam. So for people older than age 40, you should ask for a dilated eye exam every couple of years. If you're 65 and older or have diabetes, a family history of glaucoma or high blood pressure, it's important to ask for a dilated eye exam every year.
Okay. I know my mother, as I've mentioned already, had macular degeneration. Unfortunately, her big thing was cross-stitching and reading, and that was a real problem and very frustrating for her. So those are – some things are kind of difficult to fix.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it depends on the severity
right.
of that.
Yeah. I didn't mean to imply that you couldn't do anything about it, but it particularly was a difficult thing to be going through with her.
Right, because I specifically had a clinic the other day with someone who has macular degeneration and wanted to keep sewing.
Yep.
And so we had a magnifier that she could use in order to keep doing her crafts. But, the magnification on some things, you just can't get it, the size and the clarity that the person is going to want.
There's a few humans out there that are pretty stubborn, and maybe it's the people around them that notice some symptoms. Is it easy to talk about things that you may notice about grandparents or people you're working with that maybe we ought to be mentioning to these individuals?
Well, in daily activities, if a person changes the way that they're reading, watching television, walking, if they seem more hesitant going up and down the stairs, if they're walking down the hallway and they're keeping their hand on the wall, those could be issues with perception that they're just really not sure what's coming. If they are either not reading their mail at all, you see it's piling up when they used to take care of it, or when they're reading, they're holding things very close to their eyes, trying to make it out. Those are indications of perhaps some visual problems. If they start wearing oddly colored clothes, now they've always done that, you overlook it. But if they suddenly start not being able to pair things correctly, if they reach out for a cup and it kind of looks like they're missing it or they're not really sure exactly where it is, those are indications of a visual impairment.
And it sounded like you were also asking, what if you suggest to mom or dad, I'd like you to check out the Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired. It might help you out. And they say, oh, no, not me. Mm-hmm. That's certainly a challenge. People resist partly because they don't think there's anything that can be done, so they're discouraged to begin with. Some of it is just not knowing that there are options that are available because, again, this is specialized equipment and these are specialized services, and many people are not aware that they exist. One thing we talk to people about is come and try. See if there's something that works for you. These are tools that can help you adapt, tools and new ways of doing things that can help you adapt and continue to get the joy out of your life that you have up till now.
And we also like to say that the really great thing about the word low vision is that you're not blind. In low vision, there is almost always functional vision left. You just have to know how to tap into it.
Some more information about individuals with low vision or blindness. What's the age group? We've implied, or I've jumped to the conclusion that the majority of people are elderly, but that's not always true.
Well, actually, the national statistics are that of people, say the roughly 10 million people in the United States who are blind and visually impaired, 5% are under age 18. 30% are 18 to 64, and 65% are older than 65. So visual impairment is correlated with age. It's certainly not a necessary consequence of age, but it is correlated with age to some extent. We serve at our center, the majority of people we serve are older Alaskans, but we certainly also serve youth and people of working age.
And the vast majority of the working age that we see tend to be diabetic retinopathy. It's not for conditions like macular degeneration. Glaucoma is also one we see in the younger ages. But and diabetic retinopathy is predominantly the one that I see in the working age.
Deborah, tell us a little bit about what your day's like. What are you doing specifically? What's your function?
Well, I have three roles at the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired. First, I am an orientation and mobility specialist, which means that I not only run the low vision clinic, but I also work with individuals who are learning to use the long white cane and learning to cross streets, travel independently. So that's one facet of what I do. When I run the clinic, though, it's usually we have set days that we do clinic, but then if people are traveling in, such as I had a client Friday who flew in from Juneau, they come in, they set up the appointment in advance, and then I schedule about an hour to an hour and a half with each person that's coming in. And during that assessment, we start out with talking about their background history, what surgeries they've had, what have they been through, how long have they had this eye condition, what are they struggling with. And then that gives me an idea of what I need to target. And then I have them read what we call a continuous text near vision eye chart. It's different from reading the letters that you might see in an optometrist or ophthalmologist. Here I'm actually asking them to read sentences. And the reason that I'm doing that is because, as opposed to the optometrist and ophthalmologist, I'm really wanting to know what is their functional vision. When they go shopping, can they pull up that can of chicken noodle soup and tell what it is? If they buy macaroni and cheese, can they read the instructions for how to cook it? Can they go and get their mail and read their mail and do their newspapers? So I use a different kind of eye chart. Based on that, I start to show them aids and devices for their everyday life. And I always tell them that their job is to tell me one of three things. Is to tell me, I absolutely love this. Just as it is, write it down for me. Or, this is pretty cool, but we need to tweak it a little bit. We might need to change the magnification a little bit. Or, if it doesn't work for them, that's fine. But I want them to have the opportunity to experience all of the different things that are available to really try to match up best with what their needs are. So that's what I do in the clinic at the center, and I just do that with each person that comes in. And at the end, I write a report. They'll get a copy of it, and their eye doctor will get a copy of it as well. And if they're coming in with voc rehab, then we send it to their counselor. The other thing that I do at the center is I am traveling around the state of Alaska doing eye clinics. I was in Bethel last week. I was in Fairbanks. I've been to Juneau. And in those places, we contact ahead of time the optometrist, ophthalmologist, voc rehab, let them know that we're coming, the senior centers. And then we usually have a contact person that helps to set up a schedule. And I fly in and do the low visions for a day or two straight. And then fly back, and we order aids and devices for people.
And those clinics around the state are thanks to a grant from the Lions Club International Foundation, and we're just beginning a new federal grant through the Department of Education.
Alaska, for nonprofits in particular, Alaska, if you're the only one, is a large place. It's hard to get around.
Yes.
It's very expensive, and anybody who's lived here for a while understands the difficulties of that.
So. Yes, and our board is very determined that we are going to get around the state and be a statewide organization, because certainly people everywhere can benefit from these services.
A couple of thoughts came to my mind when you were talking about what you do every day, Carla. I guess one of the first things is computers are a big part of life nowadays, and I know it can be difficult to continue working on a computer as you lose vision, but there are, I'm guessing, lots of things. I mean, I know on a standard computer desktop, you can change the font size and things
like that. Well, imagine some people use computers all day long without ever looking at the screen or using the mouse. And they use what's called screen reading software. It's Audible. Huh. And we teach that at the center, and that works very well for people with severe visual disabilities or if they have a progressive eye condition that may lead to blindness at some point.
And learning the keystrokes so that you don't have to use a mouse.
Uh-huh. There are key commands for everything that your mouse will do.
I remember that. Hearing of it.
And then we also teach for people for whom it's the best choice software that enlarges the screen. And there are several versions of those. Some will work better for one person and some better for another, that do everything from enlarging the screen to giving different color combinations to different sorts of pointers for people to use that can make help them be as competitive in the workplace as anybody else on a computer.
And that's not something that I do in the low vision clinics. At the Alaska Center for the Blind, low vision is just one facet of our whole program. We also have training in ADL, activities of daily living, where we work on cooking, housekeeping, laundry, all of those activities that you would need to keep doing at home to remain independent. We also have manual skills training. We have assistive technology or computers, teaching people memo keepers and PDAs and all of those things. And then we also have orientation and mobility training, which is the use of the long white cane. And then we have low vision. As well, our center also houses the VISA program, Visually Impaired Senior Alaskans. And in that program, our coordinator can do home visits, does support groups, arranges outings for the seniors. And so there are many different programs within our one center. And the part that we're here talking about is only one small facet of the whole thing.
Let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line One. Our topic today is blindness and low vision with Carla Jetsy and Deborah Gilley of the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired. If you have questions or comments about this type of program, why don't you give us a call at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And email us at lineone, lineone, at kska.org. And remember, you can reach us live until 3 o'clock or just before 3 o'clock today, and then there's a rebroadcast of the program at 8 o'clock tonight. And you can go to kska.org/lineone and listen to this podcast at any time, as it will be archived. I did have an email message, and the question is, can someone have macular degeneration and diabetic retinopathy simultaneously?
Yes, absolutely. Diabetic retinopathy is directly related to the diabetes. And if you have diabetes, you are always at risk for diabetic retinopathy. But in addition to that, with age comes macular degeneration for some people. So you can absolutely have them coexisting.
Mm-hmm. And my understanding is we really don't have a good idea about risk factors for macular degeneration other than, I'm going to guess, the rather common risk factor of smoking, which seems to be associated with it at times, I understand.
Well,
you guys look frowning as to whether that's true or not.
Certainly,
so
recommendations.
Please don't hesitate to correct me if I'm wrong.
Recommendations for how to lower your risk of eye disease and vision loss include all the items on the healthy living list that we've heard before. Avoid smoking, eat healthy food, stay active, keep moving, control your blood pressure. I think people often don't understand that high blood pressure and stroke can actually result in vision loss. Protect your eyes from the sun is an important one. Certainly, if you have diabetes, take care of your diabetes and make sure you have an annual vision check. And this is Alaska. Let's not forget sports. Have protective eyewear on when missiles, hard balls are being thrown around in a environment. Watch out for fish hooks. That sort of thing can cause vision loss.
Yeah, I know in pediatrics, healthcare or medical problems have become secondary since the 1980s to accidents and injuries to leading reasons for being hospitalized or in the emergency room. And I didn't think about it, but trauma has got to be a huge issue.
Yes.
And I'm going to guess, particularly in the younger age group, to low vision.
Yeah, keep that helmet on if you're on a four-wheeler.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, I wouldn't say that it's common for us to see, but we have had bear attack victims. We have had gunshot victims. We have had, actually, we've had several gunshot victims. So it is a risk. I wouldn't say that they outnumber the macular degeneration or diabetic retinopathy patients that we see, but certainly I didn't ever see a bear victim when I was in Nashville, Tennessee. So it is a different world up here, and we do occasionally get those unusual situations.
Okay. Let's take – we do have a caller. I want to take Michelle. Michelle, you're on line one.
Okay. Thanks. This is Michelle Radin from the Alaska Project for the Deafblind in Anchorage. I was wondering, what services do you offer for people with blindness and other disabilities such as deafness and cognitive issues?
Okay.
We do not have people trained in working with folks who are deaf at our center. So we typically, if someone has both blindness and deafness that requires adaptation, we typically refer them to others who are specialists in that area.
But we have had people who would want to come in with an interpreter for the low vision clinic. And we try to work with that situation.
Oh sure, I'm sure that you could work with an interpreter. It's good to know. Do you work with anyone under adult age, like any school age students?
We do work with high school youth, and in fact have had in that program youth who have hearing impairments as well as vision loss. What we do in that program is provide supplemental skills to what the kids are able to get in school during the school year. So there typically isn't enough time along with academics to learn skills of independent living to the extent that they're required to help a young person move from high school to college. So we do work in that program. And Michelle, I'm glad to know your project exists.
Oh yes. We serve students in rural and remote Alaska who have hearing and vision losses, and so we travel and we do some of the same things you do, although we work more with the hearing part than the vision part. So because of my particular specialty, but I've heard all about you guys, and I know that you guys do great work, and I just want to say that I appreciate all the great stuff you do.
And that goes for you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
A question that, again, we've talked about low vision and blindness before, but I don't think the issue of Braille, when Braille is recommended, how Braille is taught, problems with Braille, and so forth. Could we address that a little bit?
Well, I'll start. We didn't bring our Braille expert with us today.
Right.
It is, by the way, the 200th anniversary of Louis Braille's birth, and Braille is named after the Frenchman who developed the tactile language. And for a young person growing up blind, Braille is often a key to literacy. And so school districts teach young people Braille. And the people we see who are the most, who know Braille the best, tend to be those who grew up with a visual impairment and learned Braille in school all along the way. For people who lose their eyesight as adults, it will be a little bit different for each person. When someone comes to our center for training, we go through quite a lengthy assessment to help them help determine with them what's the best course of adaptive skill training for them. But most people learn some Braille so that it can be of an assistance to them in public places Many people like to take notes with Braille for file folders and that sort of thing. Some like to learn more Braille and actually do reading with Braille. For someone with diabetes, they may have lost sensation in their fingertips, and so Braille's not really a good option for them because they no longer have the tactile sensitivity to read Braille. But there is Braille that is letter by letter, and then for those people who use it to read books or use what's called a refreshable Braille display with their computer, so they're actually reading their computer screen in Braille in front of them, they will use what's called a contracted Braille.
Or grade 2 Braille.
Thank you. Which has many common words.
In contractions, short forms. Mm-hmm. I almost equate it to doing a shorthand.
Right.
Because if you spelled out in Braille word for word everything that was on a screen or everything that was in a book, it would be an enormous size. Instead, we use contractions, so the words and, for, of, the, and with, which are very common words, actually have just one cell, one combination of dots that stands for that whole word. And then within words themselves, there are many different contractions so that you can take a really long word and make it in a much smaller space. So it's not as simple as just learning the alphabet to become a proficient Braille reader.
If we need to say more about Braille, let me know. But my next thought jumps to the idea of the person with the cane trying to learn to get around in the community. How does that happen? Is that something that's trained locally with yourself in particular, Deborah?
Yes.
And how do you decide when to do that and how to do that?
Well, really, when I see someone in a low vision clinic, that is one of the questions that I ask them, is questions about mobility. Do they bump into objects? Do they have difficulty on stairs? Can they cross streets safely? Do they have difficulty with curbs, drop-offs, and uneven terrains? And that is just part of the standard. When they say, yes, I have difficulty, we talk about it. It could be because they've lost some of their peripheral vision. I had somebody who came in just recently who had very good acuity but had had a stroke and was missing half of the vision in both of their eyes because of the stroke. And I talked to him about using a cane, and he said, but I'm not blind. And I said, you know, that's the biggest common misconception with using a cane, is that you have to be blind to use a cane. The vast majority of cane users are actually low vision. They have some kind of impairment that makes safe travel difficult for them. Mm-hmm. So when someone comes into the Center for Cane Training, we talk about what are the areas that they're having difficulty, and then we start with literally square one, and that is measuring them for an appropriate sized cane. And starting with, how do you hold the cane? How do you move it left and right? What is the best way to do that? From there, we move to indoor safe travel, such as going to one of the malls, and we work on just the flat surfaces, walking up and down and up and down. We work on the escalators and the elevators in the mall, the ramps, all of those things that are available. From there, we move outdoors, and we go to a small residential neighborhood with stop sign controls, and we teach them how to listen for the traffic, how to align with the traffic, how to know, if you can't see it well, when is the safest time to cross that intersection. And then it just continues to progress. As far as they need to go, we can teach them to become very independent, safe, and efficient travelers.
Yeah. The cane really can be a tool of independence for people. And there are people who are blind and visually impaired who travel worldwide, in fact, on their own with a wide cane. So it can be very liberating for people that they're not any longer dependent on someone with their wide cane and public transportation. They can get out there and do what they want to do.
Do what they want to do, right. And we also tell them that they don't have to use the cane all the time. If you're within your home and you feel safe there, you know it well, you know, you can park the cane in the corner. But when it's a safety issue, and it's also an identification issue. When you go up to somebody and you say, I need help with my grocery shopping, it's much easier if you're holding a long white cane because so many visual impairments are not visual to us as the outsider. If I look at you, you look perfectly normal. You don't have a deformity that jumps out and says you have a visual impairment. So therefore, having the long white cane and being able to carry yourself very well in public just adds to the atmosphere of what visually impaired individuals are able to do.
And I would like to add to what Deborah said when it comes from the point of view of the public. Eye conditions are so variable, and we talked a little bit about loss of peripheral vision and loss of night vision. Some people use a white cane just at night, for example, because in broad daylight they see perfectly well, but as soon as it's dark, they are effectively blind. And that's the kind of thing that will confuse people around them. Or someone uses a white cane to travel but then reads the newspaper because they have loss of peripheral vision and the cane keeps them from bumping into objects and helps them navigate, but they have acuity good enough to read through that reduced vision. So don't be confused when you see something like that. Again, people are not just sighted or blind. Most of the people who the Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired is able to help are somewhere in between.
When does operating a motor vehicle or driving become an issue? What's the limits legally for vision? Do y'all know off the top of your head?
Okay, I did some research on this in the state of Alaska, and it's a little bit fuzzy. You have to be able to read the 20/40 line or better, technically speaking.
Corrected.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So when you go in and you go to take your examination and they ask you to read in the little machine, you have to be able to read the 20/40 line or better. That is the legal requirement in the state of Alaska. But there is a little blurb that says if your eye doctor will write a letter and your vision is better than 20, I think it's 2100, but your doctor is willing to write a letter and certify that you're still safe to travel, then you can still get your license. But we kind of encourage people to think very carefully about that.
And again, I think it's more of a functional issue than it is a legal definition. And that's really the question. And I would suggest AARP is a resource. They have a driving support for seniors. And that might be a wonderful way for people to go through that class to help them do their own self-assessment of if it's time to stop driving now. And, of course, that's a terribly difficult decision for families. But AARP, I think, is a good resource in that area.
We have about 6 minutes, and we've had a flurry of emails and a phone call. So just to let you know how much time we got, we're going to try to get through what we can here. Here's an email. It says, there's a misconception that people who are blind or visually impaired cannot go to work or keep their job. Can you talk about how you can help people to keep a job that have vision loss?
Oh, thanks for that question. That's a great question. We have the governor of New York, who is blind, who seems to do pretty well. Mm-hmm. Being a governor in town. I'm aware of a lawyer who runs his own law practice, people in a variety of professions and occupations. People who are blind and visually impaired with the adaptive skills we've talked about, training in how to handle your home and your daily living tasks, training in adaptive skills for using the computer and in traveling independently and using Braille where helpful to you can be just as successful in jobs as their intelligence and talents would have allowed them to be without the vision loss. Now, they can't do everything. They're not going to be long-haul truck drivers. So there are some jobs that are dependent on vision, but far fewer than I think we typically think.
Okay. Let's go to another caller. I've got Kathy on line one. Kathy, what can we do for you?
I just have a comment of something that I saw at Frigid North store on Spinard Road that a lot of people might not know about or been there. My father had macular degeneration, and probably 15 years ago, I think it was almost $300, I bought him one of those very large lens magnifying lights with the illumination around it.
Mm-hmm.
And Frigid North just started carrying a brand, don't remember, it doesn't matter, but they have about five different varieties.
Okay.
Of these large lights, that the large one, like I had bought my father years ago, even has two different magnification lenses that you can choose. So they had one that clipped on, clamped on, I should say, another one that sat on top of a table. But they were very nice products and very reasonably priced, and they were natural light.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I immediately thought of what I had bought for my father years ago and how it enabled him to keep reading for probably three or four more years.
We do also partner with an organization called ATLA, Assistive Technology of Alaska, and they are a retailer of specialized low-vision equipment along with equipment for people with hearing loss. And again, I would reiterate what Deborah said, that people are usually more satisfied if they come for a low-vision assessment at our clinic first, and then they feel really confident that what they buy is going to work for them. And it's great that what you found there worked for your dad.
Yeah, well, I bought it from my dad years ago.
Years ago, yeah. Well, that's
a brand new product, but I don't know if the place that you mentioned, is that a storefront where people can actually go and look?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. I didn't know.
But I do appreciate that. I'll actually have to go by Frigid North and see what they have.
Do that. They were quite pleased with them.
Okay. And we didn't talk about that here, but that is something that is an issue when someone has low vision, is that lighting plays an important part.
Correct.
And to really experiment with that and find what works best for your vision, the positioning of the light to your body, to the reading source,
right. All,
you know, the kind of light, how bright it is, those are all important issues. So I'm really glad that you brought that up.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Another email. The writer states, I've heard that people are having success with acupuncture treatments for macular degeneration and other eye problems. Do you have any knowledge of this?
I would talk that over with your eye doctor.
Yeah. First of all, there has to be some mechanism by which a treatment would work, and I can't envision, with my knowledge of how the human body works, that acupuncture could affect macular degeneration and other eye problems, and I would be careful about that and really check into that one very carefully myself.
I have heard a little bit about that. I'm just not very knowledgeable on it. The main treatments for macular degeneration consists of laser surgery for wet macular degeneration when there is bleeding within the retina and they need to stop that bleeding. There's also photodynamic therapy. It's a light therapy that's used in conjunction with an injection. And then there's also injections into the eye itself. Those are sort of the main treatments for wet macular degeneration. There's also a vitamin minerals formula that is used for intermediate or advanced macular degeneration that is found to slow down the progression of the vision loss. So those are the key ones we see.
There are some, and I think it's very important when we start talking about other things, there are other very well-proven aids for macular degeneration. The first thing is you got to get diagnosed correctly and then follow through. And when you start using some unproven methods, you're really risking some extra issues here. We've only got a couple of seconds. Any final comments?
Yes, we do have tours of our center and our program for the community. And the next one coming up is April 16th at noon. If you'd like to know more, 248-7770.
Thanks very much for your time today. Quick hour as usual. I appreciate it. Next week, we'll be back and we'll be talking about urinary incontinence and kidney stones with local urologist Dr. Kevin Tamara. So join us Monday, March 9th at 2 p.m. for KSKA and for Line 1. This is Dr. Thad Woodard.
In Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.